You tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony Thursday Live, our weekly live broadcast from our studios in Prashanthi Nilayam. The time in our studios is 7:30 p.m. That means it's time for Radio Sai Answering Booth. Welcome, dear listeners, to this show of questions and answers. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, the one who presents Swami's answers to you. Many, many questions have come to this program and we are very, very grateful for that. Because thanks to your questions, we are able to explore Swami's message and, more importantly, place it in context. So that way, what Swami says is not left in the books, but made a part of our lives too, which is the most important thing. Today is the 17th of May. And it was on this very day, dear listeners, 6 years ago, we began our Thursday live broadcast. Other than a couple of us, none of us at Radio Sai really had any experience of doing radio shows, leave alone doing a live show. We did not even have a setup to start with. With a few equipment we had at our disposal, we began our Thursday live. To say the least, we were quite raw, absolutely amateurish, and pretty clueless. But we had two best inputs we could ever ask for. Inspiration from Swami and love from you listeners. You applauded and encouraged us like a child's first few steps are celebrated in a family. And we at Radio Sai cannot imagine coming so far without your love and support. Well, I'm not saying this just for the sake of saying it. 6 years is a long while, but not so long for us to forget what we were when we began and to forget the response that we've been getting from you listeners. And we know some of you have been with us through this entire journey and we cannot be grateful enough. As we always say, you listeners love Swami and that love makes you love and accept us too, in spite of all our shortcomings. We hope and pray that someday we will be truly worthy of all that love that we've received from you, and we promise we will strive hard for that. For we are sure that it is when you feel closer to Swami, when you feel connected to Swami, when you are able to embrace Swami's message, when you listen to us, we would have pleased our Swami. On behalf of all of us at Radio Sai, I thank you all, dear listeners, for giving us this opportunity to please and serve our beloved Swami. And Swami, how to thank you? All I can say is we offer ourselves at your lotus feet. Give us more and more and more love for you. For loving you has truly made this life worth living. Before I get lost in nostalgia and emotions, let's begin this week's show. And as always, I would like to quote a few very interesting lines for you before we head to the question that I have for this week. Actually, it's a short poem by a very, very great Sufi mystic. The poem I'm going to read for you is titled Tripping Over Joy. And it's from the book I Heard God Laughing, Poems of Hope and Joy, a translation of works by the Persian Sufi mystic Hafiz. I quote, Tripping over joy. What is the difference between your experience of existence and that of a saint? The saint knows that the spiritual path is a sublime chess game with God, and the beloved has just made such a fantastic move that the saint is now continually tripping over joy and bursting out in laughter and saying, I surrender. Whereas, my dear, I'm afraid you still think you have 1,000 serious moves to make. End of quote. Isn't that a glorious way of defining a saint or a wise one? As we go through life, we are constantly trying to counter the moves of God. We may call it fate or destiny either. We plan, we keep a standby plan, and we plan for the different contingencies, and we have a plan B, plan C, plan D for each of those contingencies, just like how a chess player does. It's not completely wrong, but in the process we lose the opportunity to observe the masterclass of the opponent. God really is not the opponent, so to say, but someone who plays the game with us and whose skill is always a step ahead of us. When we are too serious about our game, about winning, maybe we lose the opportunity to fall in love with God who is playing this game with us. But a saint, a true lover of God, as the Sufi mystic says, looks at each move of the master and is lost in raptures of joy. How beautiful life would really be if we are able to do that. Look at our problems, challenges and say, wow, Swami, how beautifully you have engineered all these twists and turns in my life. and I wonder how you are going to get me out of all of this. I'm sure you will, but I'm excited to see how you're going to do it. Because, dear listeners, Swami may check our moves in this game of chess, but when we surrender to Him, be sure He will Himself start hinting at the moves to come out of it too. And then we will be lost in the wonder of the problems He put us in and the way He extricated us from them. But if we are too focused on ourselves, our needs, our desires, we will take every move too seriously. Let go and start enjoying His moves. We can then enjoy the challenge, the catch, and the solution too. And when we are able to live like that, we will be tripping over with joy. Dear listeners, before we head to the question of the week, permit me to read that poem by this Persian Sufi mystic Hafiz one more time. I quote, "Tripping over joy. What is the difference between your experience of existence and that of a saint? The saint knows that the spiritual path is a sublime chess game with God, and that the beloved has just made such a fantastic move that the saint is now continually tripping over joy and bursting out in laughter and saying, 'I surrender.' Whereas, my dear, I'm afraid you still think that you have 1,000 serious moves to make." Well, dear listeners, let's head to the question that we have for this week. Last week, I had two questions from a listener because she chose to be anonymous, so we didn't name her. She had actually sent us three questions. We dealt with two of them last week. So I'm going to talk about the third. I'm going to try and explore Swami's message for an answer for the third question that she has sent us. Again, this is in her own voice, so we'll listen to it first, and then we'll see what answer we can come up for that.
Sai Ram Prem Bhaiya, I've read in many books that Swami has said that television is television, as it fills us with a poison of doubts, anger, jealousy, violence, etc. And as His devotees, we try to avoid it, or we watch only good and important programs. But sometimes, because of our dear ones, a person has to spend some time in front of the TV. For example, if a girl gets married in a family where there is a tradition of eating together in front of the TV, I think she won't be able to just take her food and eat somewhere else. When such situation arises, how does one be there without absorbing the negativity from the TV? Thank you. Sairam.
So that's the question that she sent us. Of course, the final question, or the way she ended the question, said that how do we not absorb the negative vibrations from the TV? Well, I'm not sure of that. How exactly you would watch TV and not absorb the negative vibrations. But sometime back, we had done a program as part of the afternoon satsang on this very topic of television, televisham, as Swami would beautifully play with the words. Anyone interested can listen to that. I'm not going to go back to repeating whatever was said there. But the reason why I'm referring to that particular satsang is, one of the efforts that we made in the course of that satsang is to understand why Swami actually says television is bad for us. And because when we delve into this particular theme of why it is bad, I think we get to understand what Swami says is not necessarily confined to television. At the same time, if you are in a situation where you are forced to watch television with your family or something, how then do you counter the effect of television in that sense? So anybody interested, I invite them to go and listen to that particular satsang. I think it was a two-part satsang. We had quoted extensively from Swami. We had played many, many discourse clips in that course of how watching television actually messes up with our head and That's probably a good way to start off with, by seeing how we can counter the effect of television, especially when you're not able to avoid it. Well, the question is about how the other aspect of the question, or even based on the mail that I got from the listener, the other aspect is about how do you say without hurting the other person that you don't like to indulge in some of these activities, right? If you're in a relationship, if you're in the family, you know that this is wrong, or this is something that you don't like to do because Swami has said so. How do you say that to the person that you are forced to spend time with without hurting that person? Well, that again depends on the nature of the relationship, the situation, and many other things. But I'll speak a little about the attitude we must develop in this particular regard or in such similar situations. I think then it'll automatically find its way in the way we express it, the way we say it out to the person, or the way we explain to the other person. I think I must have quoted this before too. Swami would tell us in Trai Vrindavan, you know, this is quite often, even as we near the summer vacations, Swami would give a couple of sessions in Trai Vrindavan as to how we should lead our lives when we are going for this vacation, because we know that as long as we are in Swami's hostels, we lead a very disciplined life. We don't have to worry about exposure to television or any such media. I mean, we are so busy and we are so focused on Swami thanks to the schedule that Swami has created. But when we go home for vacation, the things completely change. So Swami would invariably give us a session where he explains how we must carry ourselves when we go back home, right? And in one particular occasion, Swami had said this, that when you go home, your parents will tell you that, why don't you go watch a movie? Why don't you hang out with your friends? You know, you'll always have old friends that whom you left behind after you've joined the hostel. So they'll say, why don't you go back and catch up with your old friends or make new friends? You know, there are people next door. Why don't you go and speak to them? Right? So Swami was telling us that you should very calmly explain to them that that is not what Swami expects of me. Swami has told us that this is not, especially going back and catching up with old friends or going out for movies is something which Swami will specifically mention, that, you know, try to avoid all of that. So Swami was telling us that you should calmly explain to them that this is not what is expected of you. And the explanation that Swami gave was so very beautiful. Swami said, see, when parents ask you to do such things, they are only looking at, their intention is that you should feel happy and you should feel comfortable, and they feel that, or you've been in a, you know, in a very strict disciplined system for 10 months and you've come home, so you should be able to relax. So they suggest these things out of their love, right? They just want you to be happy and comfortable, so they're saying these things. And Swami was saying that they do not have the privilege of, or the advantage of knowing what is right from Swami himself that you are having as students, right? And they are saying whatever they're saying based on what they think is good for you. So Swami said you should, you know, understanding the intention or the motive from which it is coming, you should softly and very calmly explain to them that Swami does not like this and very politely refuse. I think that one incident of how Swami was telling us to how we should deal with this kind of situation has in it the message of what we need to do, like the question that was raised by the questioner. Most of the time, the problem comes when we operate with an attitude of, I'm holier than thou, right? That's where all the problems start. And we may not always say it openly, because what we've learned is, in Swami's presence, we know that humility is a very important attitude. So at least externally, we do not speak it in words which appear like that. We don't really behave like that. But if that thought is even there in our mind that, you know, I am doing something which is right and I am holier than thou, it will automatically express itself in the way we behave, right? It'll definitely show in our behavior, right? So the idea that I am doing what is right and what you're doing is wrong, that is what is probably going to create problem, and we have to be aware of that. So as Swami explained so beautifully, can we always remember that we are just fortunate to know that what the other person is not fortunate enough to know, right? That's what Swami was saying, that you are fortunate to have been exposed to Swami's message, to be exposed to what is right and wrong based on what Swami is saying. The other person may not have that fortune, especially if the other person is not exposed to Swami's message and is not a Swami's devotee. So Swami said that you should feel that I'm just more lucky, I'm just more fortunate that I know this. Right? And Swami would say that that thought will make you feel grateful, and that gratitude will make you feel humble and also feel responsible. You will not feel that I have something greater than you or I am greater than you. So as much as possible, initially, we must do what it takes to make the other person feel comfortable with the choice that we have made, if it is not in sync with the other person's choice. Because people hate to be told that they are wrong. And when we say people, I'm not saying about others, all of us hate to be told that what we're doing is wrong or what we're doing is not right. And this is not how Swami would expect us to do, or this is a sin, or this is completely wrong. It's very, very uncomfortable for anybody to be told that what they're doing is wrong. Right? So even if we do not say it, if our actions even give the slightest of impression, then the other person gets uncomfortable, and he or she would probably shut themselves off from your point of view, right? So how you put it across, as I said, depends on your specific scenario or the relationship that you're having with that person, right? For example, in this case of watching TV, as you said, when you do not have the habit of watching TV, because that's not what Swami expects of you, but let's say that you get into a marriage where the spouse expects you to do that, instead of straight away saying that watching TV is wrong, so I don't do it, right? That's probably the truth, but instead of saying it like that, you can say something else to start with. I don't like to watch TVs, or I get bored watching TVs, or say I like something else better. Do you like to do that? Can we do that together? Find some common interest in that manner. Maybe slowly, after you've made that person comfortable with your choice, you can explain from your point of view based on what you've learned from Swami, with the idea that, you know, that person also sees the value of what you're saying and what you're following, right? So that is, I think, one of the most important things to do. Try as much as possible to make the other person comfortable with your choice, not necessarily give them the idea that I consider this as a bad act or a wrong act. Right? That is something that we can do. In fact, I recall something one of my friends had once told me. He was a Swami student, and he would not watch movies because Swami had said many, many times during the course of his interaction with students that he does not like people watching movies. I think Swami would have mentioned it, and this boy was following it very strictly. Now, when he would go home, he had these cousins and friends who would call him out for a movie. The problem was, many of them were actually Swami's devotees, and some of them were even Swami's students, alumni, right? So when he would say that, no, I don't watch movies, they would apparently get very upset that, and ask that, is it that you're so holy and we are all sinners because we watch movies, right? That's the first question that people get, that are you trying to say that we are bad and you're good? And he was telling me how he would actually explain to them that, you know, doing one thing does not make one a sinner, or just refraining from one act does not make one a saint. It's nothing like that. It's not like not watching a movie is making me any more saintly than all of you. He told them that, see, different people try to please Swami through different acts. Each one of them, you know, somebody says that let me do more seva, or somebody says let me be regular for bhajans, or someone says that no, I'll get up every morning and do suprabhatam. So he says different people take different activities in their effort to please Swami. And I've taken up this activity or this choice that I will not watch movies, and this is how I'm going to please Swami. So it's not that I'm any better than you because of this. But this is just my offering to Swami. And he would say that that would appeal to them so much, even though they were devotees. And in fact, it's not a lie that you're saying. That is the reality. It's not like one act, doing one act or refraining from one act does not make you a sinner or a saint. We are all trying to do as much as we can to please Swami. And that is an attitude which should be there in the mind. And if it is there in the mind, if we keep that in our mind all the time, automatically the way we express ourselves will also be tempered, and it will make the other person feel comfortable. And sometime when there is an opportunity to explain, or you know, if you have, if you're very clear why Swami says that we shouldn't do certain acts, and if you are in a position to explain it to that other person in a manner that he or she can understand, then later we can talk about it, or you know, and that person will definitely will be able to appreciate our choice too. this one particular point I've spoken about earlier also, that, you know, when we exercise any amount of self-control, when we lead a disciplined life, it automatically gives us a certain amount of self-confidence, right? That's the nature of human existence itself. The moment we are able to take control over any aspect of our life, it automatically gives us a certain amount of self-confidence. But this sometimes borders on what we refer to as ego or arrogance, right? As I'd explained in the course of another answer, confidence is when I concentrate on my own abilities, but the moment I compare myself with another, I risk becoming egoistic, right? So some traits like this, refraining from certain actions that Swami doesn't like, indulging in seva or such activities or that Swami likes, will make us feel good about ourselves. There's no doubt about that. We feel that I'm doing something that will please Swami. And we should also feel grateful that there are so many who don't have an influence such as Swami in their lives. But we have. But the moment we acknowledge that, we are comparing ourselves with others, right? And as I said in that answer, the moment comparison comes, we risk becoming egoistic. So if we are just aware of this, if we keep this in mind that this is a nature, this is something that can happen, then we can always keep a check on ourselves. We can keep seeing whether this is the attitude which is creeping in, because the moment it creeps in, it will find its way through our words at some times or through our behavior at some times. And that is when actually the friction between two people start. But this question as such, the general question that was raised, also warrants a general discussion on what should one do when, say, a spouse is unable to appreciate the choices that one makes with regards to one's spiritual path. Many months ago, I had dealt with a similar question where, you know, in a marriage, the husband and wife have different views with regards to philosophy or spirituality, right? I think this discussion, the general discussion for this question, is quite similar to that. So maybe I leave that part of the discussion, much of what I said there, I'm not going to repeat it here. And I think I also have another question coming up, which is pretty similar in this theme. Maybe I'll dwell more on that when that comes. But for today, I think I'll make a few general points with regards to constraints in a family environment and the role it plays in our spiritual journey. I think that's what I thought I'll speak about today, because it's a very specific question with regards to TV. I'm not going to go into that. But a general thing, you know, when we come to Swami, when we are influenced by Swami's message, we make a few choices in our life. We want to lead our life in a certain way. It becomes all the more difficult when we get into a marriage where these choices are not appreciated, or these choices are not, there are obstacles for these choices to be followed, right? So I'd like to talk about scenarios such as that, because that's more important and that's more generic, is applicable to more people than this specific question, right? As I mentioned, at times when we do the right thing, like in this case, we say that I don't want to watch TV because Swami says so, we have this feeling that I am doing the right thing, which is right, of course. So when we have that feeling, we also have this idea that I am doing the right thing, so I should not bother about others' opinion on this. When I'm doing right, why should I be bothered about what others think of it or what are others' views on it, right? But the fact is, an obstacle-free journey does not ever teach us anything. It does not help us grow spiritually. Yes, we have to choose the right action. That is, of course, the first step. But even in doing the right thing, if I choose and I do, in a certain sense, it becomes a case of me doing what I want. It's just that what I want has become a little noble, even though the choice as such is good. That's what happens when the choice is good. What I want has become noble now, but still, if I want something and if I do it, and I go ahead doing it unrestrained, isn't that having a freewheeling of one's own ego in that sense, right? As I've mentioned many times before, of course, quoting from Swami, controlling of the mind is one of the key aspects in spirituality, right? And one of the best ways it actually happens is when we are in a situation like this, When we make a choice, we know what is right based on what Swami says. But we are put in situations, especially situations like in the family, like, again, something which I've mentioned many, many times in the course of the past few weeks in Answers, where the moment we are put in a situation where our duty takes precedence over our choices, that is when there's a typical situation like what we're talking about, where you have a choice, you've made a choice, noble nonetheless, but that choice is facing a constraint because of the duty that we have towards the family or the relationship that we are in, right? In a way, that is actually going to help us in this spiritual journey. When we discriminate and choose to be good, what happens is we manage to conquer the inner obstacles to a certain extent, right? For that matter, anything, any form of discipline, any form of choice that we make, be it as simple as waking up early in the morning or refraining from a bad habit or choosing to a certain schedule, each one of this, we are to a certain extent overcoming our own obstacles, the obstacle that we form for ourselves, right? It could be our laziness, it could be our, addictions or whatever it is. So when we discriminate and choose to do good, we, in a certain sense, manage to conquer the inner obstacles to an extent. But it is when there is some form of obstruction from the outside, that is when we are really tested. That is when we are, the test is taken to the next level, right? So on one hand, we need to face the obstacle from within, which is our own tendencies, our own habits and nature. The other leg of the challenge is when the obstacle comes from outside in the form of these relationships that we have to definitely keep in life, and we need to progress with what choices that we have made, which are based on what we believe is right and wrong, right? Like an example which I always keep giving over and over again on the show, learning to ride a vehicle like a bike or a car is always a two-step process, right? One is we must learn the technique of driving itself. That's when you master the art of driving itself. And the second is the art of driving it on a road where there are others, right? Both of these are important. You can't say that, I know how to ride a bike or I know how to ride a car, but essentially the road ahead has to be completely free and that's when I can ride it. That's not when you actually know to ride a car. So it's a two-step process. One is you master the art of riding the vehicle. You learn how to ride the vehicle one-on-one. When there's nobody else, you know how to ride the vehicle. The second step is the ability to drive it on a busy road when there are other people around, right? Without self-control, I cannot live in a society of different kinds of people, right? Without learning how to ride a bike, there's no question of riding it in a busy road. So in the similar way, self-control is the basis. Without self-control, I cannot live in a society of different kinds of people. And there is no point in saying I have self-control, but I can't live in a situation where I have to deal with others, right? It's typically by like saying that I know how to ride a car, I know how to ride a bike, but don't ask me to do it when there are others on the road. So in that sense, this is a two-step process. We have to make choices, overcome the obstacles that we ourselves face for ourselves, place for ourselves in the form of our tendencies and habits and obstructions. And the second level is, after we made the choice, we maneuver through the many relationships that we have, be it colleagues, be it our own family or the people we encounter in our life, and the ability to follow what we have chosen to follow without, in that sense, you could still be driving a car and saying that I drive it this way and bang into every other person on the road. You're still driving the car in a busy road, but you're not driving it the way you're supposed to drive. Similarly, I have made a choice. I have conquered my own nature and I'm doing what is right. But you can't say that I am doing the right thing and I'm going to do it in my own way. It doesn't matter to me if anybody is hurt in the process. It doesn't matter to me if someone's saying something and I'm being rude to that person. It doesn't matter to me. It's like saying that I know how to ride a bike and I know how to ride a car. I don't care if there are others in the road. I drive it the way I ride, right? In that sense, this is a two-step process. We need to conquer our own self, but we need to master the ability of maneuvering through the many choices that other people are going to express even as we go through life, right? It would happen many times even in Swami's presence when we are living in Swami's physical presence. Swami will give us an instruction. It could be a very mundane or very practical instruction with regards to the job that we are doing or with regards to something in the ashram or something we are doing in our hostel, in our institute. But, you know, the instruction has come from Swami himself. It's come from the purest source. But you will still face so many obstacles and it'll leave you wondering, why am I not able to do what is right? You know, Swami himself has said, Swami would call it the Vajra Sankalpa. It is like the word of God himself. That is being given, but still why am I not able to follow it? Why there are so many obstacles? Right? We can understand that if we want to achieve something, we find so many obstacles on the way. There are so many reasons for that. But here is Swami wanting us to do something. Why are there so many obstacles? Why am I not able to do it? Right? That's why Swami says, you have to live in the society, you have to take on the challenges and take it in your stride, and you have to progress and do what has to be done. And that is essentially what is the spiritual journey. And to give a flavor of that, Swami would put us through this, where Swami himself would give us an instruction and there will be obstructions and obstacles in plenty. And we need to maneuver through all of that and be able to do what Swami wants us to do. Right? And especially in a marriage or in the scenario of a family, as I've mentioned multiple times on the show, it gives us that opportunity. It gives us an opportunity to do that, right? What it does is it takes the focus away from us. Otherwise, we will be like, you know, this is what I need to do. This is what I'm going to do. I don't care about others. But in a family, when you're trying to take along others in this journey, that is when you, without your knowledge, you tend to take your focus away from yourself, right? Let us say I am a very selfish, individualistic person and I am so obsessed with my own growth, my own success. Imagine if I'm a businessman like that. I would be quite reckless, right, in the society. Everybody will look at me and say that you're such a selfish jerk. That's what they would call me, that you're so obsessed about your own growth and about your own success in life. Let's say I just replace my worldly goals with spiritual goals, right? And I'm still individualistic person. I'm so obsessed with my own growth and with my own success. Just that now it's not worldly success, it's spiritual success. It's not worldly growth, but it's spiritual growth. Won't I still be a selfish jerk? Maybe I'll be a spiritual selfish jerk. That's all, but I'll still be selfish and I would be a very reckless person, right? That's why Swami lays so much emphasis on the aspect of love in family. That is when you become selfless. That is when you take your vision out of your own growth. You don't worry so much about you doing what is necessary for your growth and for your spiritual journey. But even the aspect of love, being considerate to the other person, not wishing to hurt the other person, not wishing to harm the other person, the desire to even take the other person along. I am doing what is right. It would be my pleasure if I'm able to make the other person also do what is right. But for that, I need to ensure that I don't put off the other person by my attitude, right? So that becomes important, and that is when the aspect of love comes into the relationship. In fact, it is not only about the relationship, Swami says, it is very important for spiritual growth itself, right? Taking along others is as much part of the journey that we are taking on. As much as we progressing, taking along the others is also so very important, right? And this holds good for anything, any good initiative or any effort that we take. It could be in a family, it could be in a Sai center, it could be in our place of work or anything. It's not about we making right choices and we just recklessly going ahead and doing whatever we have chosen to do. It's about taking the right decision and also taking others along. And that's why Swami repeatedly says, purity is the starting point. Definitely, there should be purity of choice and intentions, but purity alone is not sufficient. There must be purity and there must be unity too. And that is when divinity manifests, right? So especially in a family, between spouses, it's an opportunity to take the focus off oneself, right? I'm not saying we must give up our spiritual choices and obedience to Swami if the spouse does not agree with us, but we must not be frustrated when we have to be slowed down to an extent sometimes to accommodate the other person. We must be ready to, that's why I said it's not like, oh, I have to progress and I have to become spiritual. we have to at some point realize that the situation that we are in, we have been put in that situation by Swami, and there is a lesson for that. There is a lesson in that, and considering that is part of our spiritual journey. At that point, if we say that I don't care about what others think and I don't care about if others are hurt, after all, what I'm doing is right, I will keep doing it. We're not going to make progress in that manner. We have to take along everybody in that process, and that's very, very important. So this is something that I think on many occasions, based on many questions, we've spoken of what actually the institution of a family gives us as an opportunity for spiritual growth. We often think that spirituality is always an individual journey. It is indeed an individual journey, and that's what Swami would say. There are many, many stories and Chinnakathas which Swami says about how, you know, you alone are responsible for your actions. And Swami tells that story of the transformation of the dacoit Ratnakara to Valmiki, where this is what actually wakes him up when he is told that you alone are responsible for your actions. Your family cannot come and share the sins that you're doing. So certainly spirituality is an individual journey, but the individual journey itself contains in it the welfare of the others who are around us. And that is why duty always plays a very important role. To make the right choices is important, but when we are in a situation where duty takes precedence, we have to accommodate duty as much as possible too. And that is something that we cannot overlook. So the next few minutes, I'd like to talk about a very, very important episode from the Ramayana. And it's a very profound episode. I'm sure, I think on the other shows on radio, you would have heard about this episode extensively. And this has been spoken about in Swami's presence too. But it's a very important episode. And I'd like to speak about it in a little detail. The way I'm going to speak about it is exactly how Valmiki has written it in the Ramayana, the way he has explained it. It's about the episode which happens in Sundarakandam of the Ramayana, where Hanuman has been chosen to be the emissary of Lord Rama and jump across the ocean. He's supposed to go to Mother Sita. We all know that, you know, there is this scene which is taking place. The Vanaras and Jambavan and all of them are gathered on the shore of the other side of the ocean, and they're wondering who is capable of jumping across and going to Lanka and looking for Mother Sita. And everybody is telling how many yojanas or the distance they can jump. The only person who's silent then is actually Lord Hanuman. He's just keeping quiet. He does not say how much he can jump. The reason is, I think he has this curse because of which he's not aware of his own strength. He's not aware how much he's capable of doing himself. Right? So he's quiet, and finally, I think Jambavan or somebody looks at Hanuman and says that you can do it. I know that you don't realize that you can do it, but you really can do it. And that's how Hanuman is chosen, and he is sent across this ocean as emissary of Lord Rama to go and meet Mother Sita. But the interesting episode happens in the course of this leap which Hanuman is taking from this end of the ocean to the other end of the ocean. And Swami has also spoken about this, where he meets in the process three obstacles on the way. And each one of those obstacles are different in nature. And Hanuman deals with these obstacles differently. And it's a very, very beautiful lesson which we can learn from this particular episode. And that's why I wanted to speak of this in the context of this question. Because as such, I think the question is, the answer that I've given, you could probably stop here and say that the answer is done. But this particular episode I wanted to speak about in detail because it gives a general idea of what we are supposed to do when in the process of a spiritual journey, when we find so many obstacles in our life, in the form of family, in the form of commitments that we have for work, or in the form of our own problems that we might face, right? So when Hanuman is taking this leap over the ocean, the first obstacle that he faces is a mountain by name Mainaka. Now this mountain has an interesting history. I'll not go completely into the detail of that, where this mountain has had a rift with Lord Indra, the master of the Devatas. and because of which he's taken refuge under this ocean. That's how he is under the, I'm not sure whether it's a he or a she. Let's say it's a he. Mainaka is under the ocean. The ocean has actually given refuge to this mountain. And it has also taken help from the wind god or Vayu. And because of the protection that this mountain has got from the ocean and the wind god, it is under the sea. So when Hanuman is jumping across the ocean, the sea actually tells Mainaka that, you know, here is Hanuman. Hanuman is a messenger of Lord Rama, and it's the ancestors of Rama who actually were responsible for the ocean, right? There is a king by name Sagara who has, I think, many thousand sons, and they are the ones who actually dig up this whole place to make an ocean. So the ocean tells Mainaka that here is Hanuman. He is a representative, or he's a messenger of Lord Rama, who actually belongs to the ancestors, the lineage whose ancestors were responsible for me to be here today. And he's also the son of Vayu, the son of the god of wind, who has been favorable to you. So here is an opportunity for you to show gratitude to these two people who have been to me and to Lord Vayu, who has given you refuge. So the mountain is told that, why don't you take this opportunity to show your gratitude to Hanuman? So the mountain actually starts raising from under the sea, and Hanuman is surprised, and where is this mountain coming from, right? And the mountain then speaks to Hanuman and explains this whole thing of, you know, why he's obstructing the path of Hanuman. He says, you know, I've taken favors from your father, and I've taken favors from the ancestors of Rama. So I would like to take this opportunity to offer you a little bit of respite. Please rest on me for a while, you know, take a small breather, and then you can proceed. And I'd be very happy that I'm giving you I've had an opportunity to express my gratitude, right? So Hanuman is faced with this first obstacle of Mainaka, and the mountain is actually offering a very good intentioned obstacle in that sense, if you could say it that way. The intention of the mountain is not to stop the progress of Hanuman, but it's a very noble intention with which the mountain is stopping Hanuman, right? But what does Hanuman do? He doesn't rudely brush aside the offer, because it has come with a good intention. He very calmly explains how he cannot afford to rest, because he's saying that I'm in the task and I need to be there before sun sets, and I need to go back to Rama and report to him if there's anything to be reported. So I'm in a hurry. I really cannot stop. And, you know, very lovingly appreciates the gesture. And, you know, he says that the very offer that you have made is itself an expression of your gratitude. I don't need to do anything more. I don't need to really rest on you. And he literally embraces the mountain, just touches it, and then he proceeds, right? So in other words, Hanuman ensures that the mountain does not feel slighted, or the non-acceptance of the offer that the mountain has made is taken as considering the gesture itself as wrong, right? That's what the mountain would have thought, that, oh God, I've done something wrong by asking Hanuman to rest. So very, very calmly, Hanuman explains to the mountain that this is not, you know, this is going to be an obstacle to me, but I understand that it's a very kind gesture of yours, and I appreciate that, and then moves on, right? And Valmiki writes at this point a very, very interesting thing. He says that Hanuman is not slowed. Mainaka also feels satisfied and does not feel slighted by the gesture on one. And seeing this, the sages and devatas and the divine beings come and very profusely bless Mainaka the mountain. And in fact, he goes on to write that Lord Indra is so very happy by the action that Mainaka has done, and the way Hanuman has responded to it. So he is so thrilled by the scene of Mainaka offering this gratitude in the form of this gesture, and the way Hanuman has dealt with this obstacle that has come in his place. Apparently Lord Indra is so pleased by this. So he comes and blesses Mainaka that, you know, I know that we've been enemies before, and, you know, you're afraid of me. I'm so moved by what transpired right now. So my blessings are there on you. Don't worry. I will not be a cause for your worry anymore. Right? And that's how the devatas and Lord Indra bless the mountain. I think this is a very, very important point that we all need to keep in mind. Our family and well-wishers are like this Mainaka peak. They may suggest things out of their love and concern. It comes out of very, very good intention. But nevertheless, it comes from their level of understanding, which sometimes may be lower than what Swami expects, right? So how to deal with them? There is a good intention. There is a very noble intentioned offer which is coming, which probably, if indulged in, is going to derail our journey. So how do you deal with them? Hanuman is the perfect example. But when we do that, and when we are able to take them along, as I said, instead of putting off the other person by saying that, oh, what you're saying is, what you're doing is wrong, or I don't do these mistakes, then you put them off, right? You make the other person comfortable with the choice that you make, even by saying something which is not necessarily directly saying that this is wrong, so I don't do it, or this is not what Swami expects of us. Put it across in a more pleasing way, and bring that person to understand your way and why you're doing it. And when we do that, Swami says that you actually not only get blessings for your own self and you progress, you are in a situation where you can bring blessings on that person too. And that is why it's such an important thing. So we'll have the ability to bring benefit to them through our way of dealing with the situation. And that is why this particular episode is very suitable for situations like the question raised. Now, going on with the story, the second obstacle is a more interesting one, right? Now, the gods and the sages and the divine beings approach the mother of all the Nagas, and her name is Surasa, right? Surasa or Surasa. They go up to her and say that, you know, please assume the form of a demoness and obstruct Hanuman this time. Imagine the gods are going and requesting Surasa to take the form of a demoness and obstruct Hanuman. And they say to her that we want to see if Hanuman has the required strength to accomplish the task that he is going to achieve. So she assumes this form of an ogress, and, you know, she stops Hanuman and says, Hanuman, I have a boon from Brahma. I'm in this ocean. I have a boon from Brahma that whoever passes through this region, whichever being passes through this region, has to become my food. So this is a boon that I have from Brahma. So you are here. You have to enter my mouth, right? Now Hanuman is in a fix. You know, Hanuman realizes that this is actually a legitimate request or a legitimate obstacle, if you could call that, right? Because it is a boon granted by none less than Brahma himself. So he needs to honor the boon which Lord Brahma has given to this ogress. And that's how he looks at the situation, right? So he cannot be rude, and he cannot, you know, just walk over this obstacle that has come. So what does he do? Valmiki writes that he starts growing bigger. And when he grows bigger, she grows bigger and opens the mouth wider. And in this manner, it goes on and on, where Hanuman grows bigger and she grows bigger, and Hanuman goes even bigger and she grows bigger and opens a wide mouth wider. At one point, the ogress has become such a huge being, and the mouth is wide, wide open. And quickly Hanuman becomes a tiny being, the size of a thumb, and he goes inside the mouth, and before the ogress can take a smaller form and swallow Hanuman, he comes out and he looks at the ogress and he says, so I have satisfied your condition. You know, the boon that Brahma gave you is that whichever being passes through this place has to pass through your mouth, and I've gone in and I've come out. And seeing this, Surasa is extremely pleased. And she assumes the form of her original form, the mother of all the Nagas. And she blesses Hanuman that, don't worry, my blessings are on you. Whatever task you're going for will be accomplished. And she says, you will be instrumental in bringing Vaidehi back to Lord Rama. I bless you thus. There are three important points in this particular episode, which is very, very interesting. And I'd like to call your attention to that. First and most interesting one, the obstacle is itself created by the gods. It is they who go and tell that create this obstacle for Hanuman. Sometimes the obstacles on our path in our spiritual journey is created by Swami himself, directly willed and created by Swami himself. We must always remember that. And why does he do that? Like in the story, it is to test our ability, right? That's what the gods tell him. We want to test if Hanuman has the ability to achieve this task. So the question comes, does Swami not know our capacity and capabilities? Does he have to test us to know what we are capable of? Well, definitely he knows, but the problem is we don't know how much we are capable of. That's why this example of Hanuman is beautiful, because Hanuman is this person who has forgotten his own abilities and strengths. So this episode is a situation in the story where he himself discovers his abilities. And finally, in this episode, Hanuman's use of his intelligence, or what Swami would refer to as yukti, right? What can be solved by smartness and intelligence must be solved using that. Force or anger is not necessarily required in every situation. If we can use our intelligence, use our yukti and solve a problem without harming the other person, without harming ourselves, without slowing our progress, Swami says that it has to be used. But I think our nature is, especially when we are young, invariably force is the first recourse, right? We always turn to using our might first. Not necessarily physical might, but, you know, just our arrogance or the firmness in our words. So Swami says that's not how you have to do. You have to use your intelligence first, right? And when you do that, you will discover your own strengths. That's what Swami says, like Hanuman has done in this process. He discovers that he is able to handle this situation. And finally, when Hanuman does manage to get over this obstacle, he is blessed by Surasa herself to be successful in his mission. So when we are trying to do good work, especially when we are, this is a typical example of what happens in the Sai circle, in Sai centers, in Swami's organization or in the ashram, we will find people who will invariably quote Swami and obstruct our work. This is so common, right? I'm not saying that they're misquoting Swami. They really quote Swami. They would say that this is what Swami had told on a different occasion, or this is what Swami had told us, or this is my approach because Swami had instructed me this way, right? So sometimes they may genuinely believe that Swami expects us to do something else when you're trying to do something, right? In such cases, I think we must first of all acknowledge that this is an obstacle which is typically been engineered by Swami, like Surasa in this case, who's been told that go and obstruct this fellow, right? And in such cases, when we acknowledge that, we must counter that obstacle with our astuteness, right? Maybe equip ourselves with better understanding and convince them through arguments. That could possibly be one of the ways out, where we dwell deep. When somebody questions or places arguments in front of us for which we do not have answers, we think more deeply, or we go back to Swami's literature and we try to understand Swami's message better. So we equip ourselves intelligently to overcome these obstacles, right? This is something that we can keep in mind. For the case of, you know, an obstacle which comes, which typically is an obstacle which is born out of, you know, Swami's own words itself. The final obstacle that Hanuman faces in the course of this particular journey that he's taking is actually a real demon. You know, that's when a real demon comes, and the demon's name is Simhika. A demoness by name Simhika comes, and she's also called the Chayagrahi or something, if I'm not wrong. The name is given to that demoness because she captures her prey by holding the shadow. You know, that's how the description is. So the story goes that Hanuman is flying across the ocean, and suddenly he finds that something is obstructing him, something is tugging him back when there's nothing around him. And that's when he realizes that it's this ogress, and she has caught hold of his shadow and is pulling him back, right? The moment he notices this, the moment he sees that it is this particular ogress who captures her prey through the shadow, Hanuman recognizes her, because apparently he has heard of her already from Sugriva. You know, Sugriva has already told about her that there is an ogress like this. So the moment this situation happens, Hanuman recognizes her. And this probably could be a very symbolic imagery that, you know, Valmiki is trying to portray, or, you know, the story itself is trying to tell us. Maybe this act of catching one by one's shadow is like a sign of those who try to become obstacles to us through the flaws that are in us, right? They try to capitalize on our weaknesses and basal nature, right? That is what this could probably symbolize when the ogress is catching its prey through the shadow. So one set of obstacles that we might face in our life are genuine obstacles, or in that sense, when you're saying that finally we have a genuine demon, right? In that sense, people who really want to capitalize on our weaknesses and basal nature and try to pull us back, right? As I said, the beauty of this episode is the moment Hanuman realizes that it is this ogress that he has heard about from Sugriva, he realizes that this is a real ogress, right? This is a real obstacle. And here he does not give time for negotiation or trying to be calm and trying to be pleasing to this person. He realizes that this is something which can pull him down very fast, because it is something that works on his weakness, right? And he becomes very, very alert the moment he recognizes that it's this ogress. So being prepared and being aware is very, very important when it comes to facing such obstacles which will utilize our weakness and our basal nature. And that's why I keep saying, most times to recognize and acknowledge what is the problem itself prepares us to face the problem. And that's why Hanuman, being aware of this particular ogress, alerts him immediately. And immediately, Valmiki says that Simika, Hanuman was able to conquer because of his own self-control. That's the word he uses, because this is an obstacle which works on your flaws. And because Hanuman had so much self-control and Hanuman was aware of this particular ogress beforehand, the story goes that he enters her. This is again an ogress which is trying to swallow him. He goes inside and he actually tears apart the insides of this particular ogress, kills this ogress, and then moves on, right? And at this point, after this episode, all the divine beings bless Hanuman profusely, and there are a series of verses where Valmiki says that how pleased the beings, the celestial beings were watching this whole episode are with Hanuman. The way very astutely he handles each one of these obstacles, and he also recognizes that this is an obstacle which should not be engaged with, which should not be negotiated with, and he actually literally kills her and goes ahead. So the gods and the beings are so impressed. So in many, many verses that Valmiki writes, they explain how they are thrilled with the acts of Hanuman. And in the course of that, one of the verses that he writes is a very, very beautiful and very important one. And, in that he says, Yasya Tvetani Chatvari Vanarendra Yatha Tava Dhriti Drishtir Matir Darsham Saha Karmasu Na Sidati. The meaning of that verse is, he says, O Lord of Vanara, Yasya Dhritihi, in whom Dhritihi, fortitude, Drishtihi, vision, Matihi, intelligence, and Dakshyam, or dexterity, one who has all of these four qualities. I'll repeat that again. Dhritihi, fortitude, Drishtihi, vision, Matihi, intelligence, and Dakshyam, dexterity. In whom these four qualities are there, in whom these four qualities exist, as it is in you, O Hanuman, will achieve his mission and not get lost when faced with obstacles. And this, I think, is the verse which is very, very important for all of us to be able to complete the spiritual journey, to be able to surmount the obstacles that come. The obstacles sometimes are noble, as Swami would sometimes put it. These three obstacles are actually sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic also. So Swami says that obstacles are not always demons and ogresses which come. Some of them are in the question itself, where our duties to the family, where our mother or father or the spouse comes and from their point of view, from their level of understanding, suggests something which may not be in line with what Swami expects of us. How you deal with them cannot be the same way you deal with a person who's typically trying to pull you to something which is wrong, knowing that it is wrong, right? So as we go through life, all these techniques have to be utilized. And I personally feel, I think it's quite easy for us to assess which person is coming from. I mean, if we are careful and if we are able to observe more keenly, I'm sure we will be able to find out which category each one of these people who form obstacles in our path fall in, right? So that is why I thought I'll narrate this particular episode. It's a very, very beautiful episode. The interesting thing is the question is about the problems we face in our family life, But the examples for that is from the greatest celibate that we know, who is Hanuman, who has given us the beautiful message of how we have to tackle the obstacles that we find even in family life or even in Grihastha Ashrama. That's the beauty of this episode, and that's why they say that the Sundara Kandam, reading it itself, will give you all the essence of what needs to be learned from the Ramayana, because each one of the episodes have such very, very deep meaning, and that's why I thought I'll narrate this. But in general, as before I conclude, Swami would say the spiritual quest or the spiritual aspirant should always be like the river that is trying to reach the ocean. Swami would say that is the kind of attitude with which you have to pursue your spiritual path. If you look at any river, if you see the course of any river, for example, let's say River Ganga, if you just follow the course of that whole river, you will be stunned by the variety of terrains that this one river has to go through. Starting from the place of origin, which is actually a glacier, Gangotri, right? It flows through mountains, it flows through valleys, rocky slopes, there are plains, marshlands, forests, and even worse, they even have to flow through cities and towns. But the river keeps flowing towards the ocean because its intent is always about reaching the ocean. Sometimes it breaks through the barriers, sometimes it weathers down patiently the rocks that stand in its way, and sometimes it spreads out into the plains, and in such places it actually starts moving very, very slowly when the basin is wide. But since its focus is always on the destination, Swami says, the river keeps moving in the direction, and come what may, it will eventually definitely reach the ocean. And Swami would say that we must have such an approach to our spiritual pursuit. Some things may slow us down, some things may make it more difficult for us to follow what Swami says, but if our intention is always in that direction, Swami says that you will find ways of maneuvering through these obstacles. And like the river does, the river also manages to bring along the soil right through to the ocean. And in that manner, if we are sincere, if we are our approach is right, we can actually take along all those people who become obstacles to us as part of this journey, and we will be able to be instrumental in their progress too. So this is what I thought I'll share with all of you. Thank you, sister, for that question and for the question that you sent us last week. I hope what I said gave you something to think about. I'm sure none of the answers that we give is actually directly applicable to the problems, but it should only inspire to find your own answers from within, and that's something which we always keep saying. So thank you for the question. It gave us an opportunity to dwell on something which is very, very important. With that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wrap up this week's show. Thank you for joining me. If you have a question on practical spirituality, I would love to feature it on the show. You can send me your question. I receive questions directly to my personal mail ID. That's prem@radiosai.org, prem@radiosai.org. Like today's listener, if you can send your question in your own voice, that would be beautiful. We'll love to play it in your voice and then answer your question. If you wish to be anonymous, do let me know. I'll not mention your name on the program. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Thank you all for your very patient listening. I'll see you all again next week for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. I'm going to leave you with a beautiful song. Well, we spoke so much about Hanuman, why not a bhajan on Hanuman? So I'm going to leave you with a bhajan on Hanuman, on the other side of which you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and Saprakash for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all next week, 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. Manojavam Maruta Tulya Vegam Jitendriyam Buddhi Matamarishtam Vatatmajam Vanayudha Mukhyam Shri Ramadutam Sharanam Prapatye Shri Ramadutam Sharanam Prapatye Shri Ramadutam Sharanam Prapatye.
वायु कुमारा वानर वीरा
वायु कुमारा वानर वीरा
वायु कुमारा वानर वीरा अति बलवंता हनुमंता अति बलवंता हनुमंता केसरी नंदन अंजनि पुत्रा केसरी नंदन अंजनि पुत्रा जय हो पवन कुमारा जय हो पवन कुमारा।